Velvet Sky, Arizona, written by J.C. Halsey, narrated by Chaz Allen. Chapter 1. Orville Halfloaf and myself were on our way to Velvet Sky, Arizona territories. We decided to go there when I remembered Paw telling me that he had a younger brother living there. Said there were 4 brothers that came by wagon train from Chicago, ranging from 17 to 20 in age. They were of Irish descent, their Ma and Pa had passed on, and there was nothing to keep them in Chicago. My Pa, being the oldest, was supposed to make the decisions for them. James Seamus was the second born, then Francis Leroy and Justin Lucas was the youngest. When they passed through the Texas Panhandle, they decided to part ways because of the tension that was building between them. They weren't happy with the decisions Pa was making, so Pa decided to head to South Texas, where he heard there was a need for a good blacksmith. They said their goodbyes, and Pa headed south. Then the 3 remaining brothers headed west to California. Pa found out later that James had stopped in a little settlement called Velvet Sky in the Arizona Territories. According to the correspondence he had received, Uncle James had a big cattle spread situated in a valley below the mountain range just east of Velvet Sky. Orville said, "I think we should stop in the next town to get this buckboard checked over and have it repaired, as it's needed for a trip like this, and maybe we should consider getting another horse to help Whitey." That's the Palomino that he had bought from Señor Marietta at his rancho in South Texas. "And pull the wagon. Maybe I'll trade that no-good saddle that I thought I was going to use." He had traded for a saddle when we were at Trader Tom's Trading Post. "That sounds good to me," I said. "How about us finding a spot to camp for the night?" Orville said, "I've always wanted to see how them cowpokes rope those cows and brand 'em." Halfloaf said, "I am ready to travel, just to see this beautiful and wonderful country of yours." As I looked at the countryside, I couldn't understand Halfloaf's description. There were sporadic tufts of trees, on-again, off-again grasses and shrubs, as far as the eye could see. It was a surface that looked as hard as stone, and even less inviting. "Well, I reckon we need to check our supplies and head in that direction," I exclaimed. Chapter 2. Suddenly, a windstorm blew up and dust was everywhere, on leaves, branches, even on my teeth and lips. Then, just as suddenly, it stopped, and in the distance I saw what looked like an oasis, a green strip of thick grass that carpeted the narrow strip along its length. Cottonwood trees had sprung up, young trees, more than twice a man's height. What a welcome sight, after just experiencing a dust storm. I waved my comrades and pointed to the green strip ahead, and we all headed towards it. And the air turned cooler as we got closer. "Almost feels like winter, don't it?" Orville exclaimed. We all jumped down and ran to the banks of the little spring, falling down and placing our faces into the water to drink our fill. What a glorious, cool, sweet-tasting refreshment it was. When my thirst was slightly quenched, I rose and told the guys we needed to water the animals. Orville unhitched Whitey. Halfloaf and me led our horses along with Orville to the little stream and let them drink their fill. As they were drinking, I stood in awe at the miracle that God had created. Such a wonderful paradise in the middle of this vast, dry land. It looked as if the stream just bubbled up out of the ground and rushed along for about 50 yards and then disappeared back into the ground. Halfloaf suggested that we set up camp and enjoy this wonderful wet place, take baths, wash our clothes, especially Orville. Orville said he couldn't help it if he sweated more than most folks. It was something he inherited from his daddy's side of the family. We enjoyed the rest of the day, swimming and splashing in the cool water, and then we washed our dirty clothes. When we had hung all the wet clothes on the low branches of the trees, we started a fire and cooked something to eat. Orville boiled some rice and fried up some prairie hens that he shot this morning, then mixed them together for a superb meal, with rice pudding for dessert and a fresh pot of hot coffee. It was a delicious meal and one fit for a king. Halfloaf cleaned the dishes, put them away. We all helped set up the tent, then unrolled our bedrolls and bedded down for the night. When I finished saying a prayer, Halfloaf said, "I would like to know this God with whom you talk. I will be glad to introduce him to you. Do you believe the Bible is the Word of God?" "See, yes, I believe it is true." "The Word of God tells us in Romans 3:10, as it is written, there is none righteous. No, not one. That means I'm not righteous, you're not righteous, no one is righteous. Then it says in Romans 3:23, for all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. Well, that means that I have sinned, and you have sinned, and everyone has sinned. Then in Romans 6:23, for the wages of sin is death, but the gift of God is eternal life through Jesus Christ our Lord, because we are all sinners, and we deserve to die. But God said we don't have to die if we accept the gift he has for us. Romans 5:8 and 9 says, but God commendeth. That means gives proof of his love towards us, in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. God gave us his only Son so that we would not have to die but have everlasting life. Salvation cannot be earned. Everyone's a sinner and deserves death, but God gives eternal life if we accept Jesus Christ as our Savior. All you have to do is tell God that you are a sinner and you want to accept Jesus as your Savior. Yes, said Half Loaf, I wish to do that. Just bow your head and ask God to save you. Half Loaf did just that, and that night another soul's name was added to the Book of Life. Not only did we get to enjoy this beautiful green pasture that God created, but we also had the privilege of showing someone the way into heaven. Isn't it a wonder the way God weaves people into our lives? It was a restful night. I slept soundly and woke the next morning refreshed, ready to leave. We enjoyed warmed-up supper that was left over from last night and then cleaned the dishes. We stowed the tent in the wagon, headed towards the next town, which was about 50 miles due east. Chapter 3. After 2 days of traveling, I pulled up on Sugar's Reins and stared at the trail ahead, then turned in the saddle and looked at the dusty trail behind. It looked like silver water running off a duck's back, and the land in front of me seemed to sizzle like a burning flame. Some of the terrain looked vaguely familiar, but upon looking a second time, it didn't look anything like I had seen before. As I took yet another look, the subtle rise and fall of the land all looked the same. The temperature hadn't changed 1 degree in the last 6 hours, and there was no wind blowing except a slight breeze every half hour or so. It seemed as if the wind might be hiding just over the next rise, waiting to surprise us. Then as we rode over that next rise, there always seemed to be another rise hiding the wind. I lifted my eyes towards the west where the ground was bathed in a purple gray and the sun was ever receding behind the horizon, then turned and waved for Orville and Halfloaf to follow in that direction. We traveled for another hour and a half, then stopped under some giant oak trees to rest. We tethered the horses to some low-hanging branches, and Halfloaf brought 2 buckets of water over to let 2 of the horses drink their fill. Then he allowed the other 2 to drink. Orville had gathered some firewood and had a campfire going in no time at all, while I started getting the cooking pots and set them over by the fire, and then I went back to the wagon and retrieved the tripod to hang the pot over the fire. Soon as Orville had the fire going, he started peeling some spuds. Just then we heard 2 shots. Orville ducked behind the wagon, and I fell to the ground right where I was standing. Halfloaf came walking into the camp, talking really fast in Mexican, with his head hanging. "What's wrong, Halfloaf?" I asked. "I saw a couple of rabbits, and I tried to shoot them for our meal, but I missed, and they ran off," he answered. Orville said, "Oh, we got to teach this kid how to shoot, and shoot straight." "See, I am ready to learn," said Halfloaf. "Well, let's have something to eat first, and then we'll have your first lesson," I told him. After we finished with the meal, I went with Halfloaf some distance beyond the camp. "First of all, we're not going to try to teach you any fast draw stuff or anything like that. We just want you to shoot straight," I told him. We shot at targets until we ran out of cartridges for his pistol. "We'll have to replenish your supply at the next town," I told him. We got back to camp. Orville was mixing up a batch of biscuits. He added a little more flour to the ingredients and stirred vigorously. He didn't make biscuits very often, but when he did, they were the flakiest I had ever tasted. He placed the last biscuit into the Dutch oven. 6 is all we get tonight because we're completely out of flour. "We sure need to find a town or settlement real soon. Flour's not the only thing we're running short of," he said. I watched him mix the batter, then pinch off a portion of the dough, flatten it, and place it in the Dutch oven, resting on the fire. The aroma was heavenly, and it caused my stomach to growl. Orville said, "Better grab a plate, dish up some of those spuds and beans. These biscuits will be ready in just a bit." Do you think we should give him the special thing we have for him? Asked Half-Loaf. Special thing you talking about? I asked. Orville spoke up and said, We took those varmints' guns and stuff back to the mercantile back there in Angel Falls. He had something new. Said it came all the way from Chicago. Something he called a tin can. And listen to this, there's peaches in that can. Yep, peaches. That's the special something I told you I got for you. And how do we get those peaches out of the can? I asked. Just so happens a storekeeper had something called a can opener. I got one of them, too. Minutes later, we sat enjoying the fire's warmth and the quietness of the night, eating beans and taters with flaky biscuits and washing it down with water from the canteen. It was a simple meal, but quite enjoyable. We were all amazed at the tin can, especially when Orville used the can opener. There were four peach halves inside the can. Since these are a special treat for you, Jed, you can have two peaches, Orville said. When I finished with the peaches, I looked across the fire at the faces of my two friends. Their tan faces were glowing like shining bronze. I laid the tin plate aside and exclaimed, That's the best special gift I've ever received. Thank you very much, both of you. After the dishes were cleaned and put away, we rolled out of bedrolls and hunkered down for the night. Lay my head in my pallet, rolled onto my back, and stared up into the night sky, letting my eyes wander from star to star, then said a prayer for the fantastic friends that God allowed to come into my life. I rolled back onto my side, and as I felt the weariness of the day creeping into my bones, I closed my eyes as darkness enveloped me. The next thing I knew, I was looking into the sun, thinking how it resembled a sparkling jewel on the bosom of the hard-packed earth ahead. Chapter 4 We loaded up, saddled our mounts, and headed due east. As we crossed from Texas into New Mexico territory, we came to a town called Windy Butte. It was a real metropolis when compared to the places we'd been. We went straight down Main Street and stopped at the livery stable near the end of town. I noticed that the streets were empty, not a soul to be seen. Most of the businesses were locked up. The saloon, however, the fourth building down from the livery stable, was open and very loud. We stopped in front of the livery stable. Then the door opened and a little man wearing an old miner's cap, leather trousers, and a green shirt stuck his head out and said, Let me open the big door. You can bring your animals inside.
Where's all the people? I asked the old-timer.
Everybody's locked up tight, afraid to show their faces, afraid of getting killed, he answered.
Can you maybe explain on that just a little? I said.
Well, you see, it's them, Swearinger brothers, Clem and Clyde, them most vicious men I've ever seen. Clyde worships his big brother and hangs on his every word, and is more than willing to join him in whatever evil deed Clem is attempting. 3 days ago they robbed and killed a man and his wife, took the little 10-year-old daughter out to the barn, and had their way with her. Then they strung her up and slit her throat. As they left, they torched the house and ran off all the stock. A most horrendous act that needed to be answered for. They rode into town big as you please on two big stallions prancing down Main Street and tied up in front of the saloon. They strode in laughing loudly and bragging about how the little girl screamed, and they're still over there at the saloon drinking and laughing and bragging. Something needs to be done. The sheriff is hiding out in his office afraid to face him.
Right about one thing, old-timer, I said.
Yeah, what's that?
I reckon if nobody's going to step up and do this job, then guess it's up to me to get her done.
Orville said, You don't have to do this, Jed's not your responsibility.
If not me, then who? I turned into the street and walked towards the saloon, removing the tie down from the hammer of my pistol.
Stood out in the middle of the street in front of the saloon. The boardwalk was littered with empty bottles and crumpled trash. Tinty piano music drifted through the doorway, and the sickening smell of liquor assaulted my nostrils. I hollered for the two men who were inside, celebrating, to come outside. A couple of minutes passed, and the door of the saloon opened slowly, and two men stepped out onto the boardwalk, one to the left side of the door weighing 180 pounds. He was 5'9", with a broad, round face, pleasant features, brown skin tanned by the sun. His eyes were blue and very expressive, and he had broad white teeth, a square, brawny form, though well-proportioned, with every muscle fully developed. The other one stopped just outside the door. He was a medium-sized, tow-headed sort of man with liquid blue eyes and a mouth that stretched nearly ear to ear. His face was as smooth as a baby's bottom, and he didn't have a particle of hair on it. Walked with a shuffling, half-apologetic sort of gait, had a squeakish, boyish voice with an awkward, gawky manners.
"What you want, kid?" You the one doing all that caterwauling out here? He screeched.
First of all, I said, I don't like being called kid. Secondly, you can do me a favor. Come with me to the sheriff's office to confess your sins and be locked up, or if you prefer, I will introduce you to the devil, and you can confess to him.
I ain't going no place with the likes of you. Better step aside or I'll walk right over you, said the other one.
Like I said, and I'm asking nicely, come along and everything will turn out all right. He looked at me as if I were invisible, and at that moment I saw his eye twitch just a tad. I drew and fired just as his gun cleared the holster, and he was slammed backwards to the saloon door as the bullet entered his chest just above the heart. His brother threw his weapon into the street and raised his hand in surrender.
I didn't do nothing, honest. He was the one that did it all. I didn't do nothing, he exclaimed.
I suggested to Clyde that he mount up right out of town, without looking back. That's exactly what he did, leaving his pistol lying where he had thrown it. I was replacing the spent cartridge when I spotted the sheriff headed towards me. I was just holstering the pistol when he asked, "What happened here? Who are you, and who is that man?" He pointed at the dead man. The town suddenly came to life. Doors started slamming and folks started gathering around, making a lot of noise.
"Asked you a question, kid," sheriff said again.
"Wish people had stopped calling me that," I said softly.
"What's that? Speak up, boy," said the sheriff.
"My name's Jed Jenkins. Me and my friends just arrived in town a little while ago. When I heard of the devil's spawn running loose in this town, I decided something needed to be done, so I did it," I answered.
"Devil's what? What is it you're saying? Did you shoot that fella or not?"
"I was doing what nobody else had the nerve to do, and that includes the sheriff of this town. This evil deed was committed by two men, and I just couldn't let them get away with it, especially when no one was stepping up to correct the wrong. The owner of the livery stable told me what these men had done and how they was bragging about it all over in the saloon. So, yes, I did shoot him.
Maybe you'd better come with me back to my office and let's see if there's a flyer on you."
"Sure thing, Sheriff. I wouldn't want to do anything wrong or upset you in any way whatsoever.
After you, I'll follow."
"Charlie, you and some of these men clean up the mess," said the sheriff.
Chapter 5. I fell in behind the sheriff and marveled at how he was able to stand up straight, let alone walk. He's probably 6 feet tall and had a head that looked as big as a watermelon. Looked too big for a skinny body. He weighed maybe 110 pounds, with a pockmarked face, long stringy hair hanging to his collar, and he wore a big 10-gallon hat with a crown that hadn't been shaped yet. His double holster setup looked away as much as he did. We reached the jail, and he motioned for me to go on ahead of him, so I stepped into the well-lit room. It had windows all along the front wall, and there was a wooden rail fence separating the entrance from the main office, which held a desk and two file cabinets. There was a rifle rack beside the door of the cells in the back, and the desk was a big mess with paper strewn all across the top. I turned to face the sheriff and found myself looking straight into the barrel of a Colt 45.
"What's the meaning, sheriff?" I asked him. "I think you better unbuckle your sidearm and place it on the desk and open that door and step into one of those cells while I look over these posters and see if you're wanted anywhere."
"Making a mistake, sheriff," I told him. "I think you're just trying to cover your unwillingness to act by blaming somebody else for something, anything to make yourself feel useful. You know, I did you a service by eliminating that scum for what they did to that family, especially for that little innocent 10-year-old girl, and maybe, just maybe, saving your life in the process." He lowered his weapon, hung his head, and said, slightly above a whisper, as he glanced up at me with smoky gray eyes, "I didn't want to be sheriff. It was forced on me by the mayor and his cronies. He owns most of the businesses in town, including the saloon, which was my downfall. Gambled too much, lost more than I could afford, and the only way I could square up with him was to take this job and do whatever he told me to do. I didn't realize at the time that the deck was stacked and the dealer was crooked as a snake. No way I was going to win. Then he took my place as collateral. I'd worked for 5 years for it. And it was just starting to pay off when this happened. I'm not a gunman, I'm a farmer, and that's just what I wish I could do. My name's Jackson Hadley. Me and my wife and my boy are living in the sheriff's little house behind the office. It consists of two very small rooms. Let me tell you, my wife is one very unhappy woman.
Whenever I would lose at gambling, I would sell off livestock, then all my tools. Finally, all that was left was the homestead. It's like a disease with no cure. No matter how hard I tried, I couldn't stop. But you know, since I've been sheriff, I haven't gambled any at all. Funny, ain't it? Now with nothing to lose, I don't have any desire for it. Well, maybe there's a way, I said. Why don't you just have a seat and wait for me to check into this matter? I'll let you know something real soon. You'd do that for me? The sheriff said, someone you don't even know? I feel that God has ordained a certain path that he wants me to follow, I said. And when he places a person in that path that needs help, I feel obligated to do the best I can to help them. I feel that you are one of those people. Sit tight, and I'll get back to you as soon as I take care of a few things. Chapter 6. I left his office and went to the telegraph office to send a wire to the bank in Angel Falls, Texas. I asked them to convey to the bank here in town that I needed some money and to transfer it from my account. I had just left the telegraph office when a group of men came up to me. The finest dressed man stepped forward and extended his hand. I'm Colonel Beauregard T. Madison, the mayor of this fine town. We have a proposition we'd like to discuss with you. Could you please follow us to my office just up the street? Sure, I said. I've got a few minutes to spare. Lead the way. We walked past the businesses, and I noticed that most of them had the name Madison on them, exactly as the livery stable owner had told us. When we reached his office, he turned and said, "Thank you, gentlemen. That'll be all. Please return to your duties." Looking at me, he said, "Would you please come inside? This is my brother Theodore. He helps out with my business ventures. Don't know what I'd do without him." A young girl came bursting through the back door. "Daddy, Daddy! Oh, I'm so sorry, Daddy. I didn't know you were in a meeting. I'll come back a little later." "Well, that's okay, baby. Let's go to the back room, and you can tell me what it is you want." "I apologize, sir. This is my daughter, Melody Susan Madison. Now, if you'll excuse me, I will return shortly." Theodore stood and said, "Don't know what he wants you to do, but whatever it is, you need to leave as fast as you can, I assure you. He's up to no good." I said, "Well, I appreciate the warning, but I need to see this through to the end, whatever it might be." "Don't say I didn't warn you. Whatever happens, my hands are clean," said Theodore. "My brother was in the army, all right, but he sure as heck weren't no colonel. He was a corporal. Makes him feel important when they call him colonel. Me and Beauregard made it through without injury, mainly because we served in headquarters. I was a general's clerk, and Beau was in the general's private mess detail. That's as close as either of us got to a colonel. I take care of his legitimate dealings, and I refuse to get involved with the shady ones." The back door opened, and the mayor came back inside and said, "Now, where were we? Ah, yes, I was about to offer you the job of sheriff of our fine town." "I thought you already had a sheriff," I said. "One of your choosing, if my information's correct." "Yes, I'm sad to say he was indeed my choice, but as you probably noticed, he's just not up to the task. So what do you say? Will you accept the position? I can assure you it is a very lucrative position for the right person." "Don't you think I'm a little young for the job?" I said. "What do folks say about someone so young being the sheriff?" "Well, I believe most folks in town saw what transpired between you and the Swearinger brothers, and how it turned out. Besides, if anyone questions you, I have no doubt whatsoever that you are capable of handling it." "I don't know, Mayor. I need time to talk it over with my partners. May I give you an answer in perhaps 2 or 3 days?" "Fine, fine. I'm sure you will make the right decision. Please come by the office here and let Theodore know what you decide. Theodore has consumption. He's not able to do any strenuous work. We moved here to Arizona Territories because of Theodore's illnesses. He inherited this little plot of land just outside of town from our grandfather right after the war ended. Grandfather didn't live very long after the war. He was very upset because the South surrendered. He was too old to serve, but he saw to it that his sons and grandsons served. The Madisons used to own the largest plantation in Virginia, and Grandfather won this plot of land in a poker game. After the war ended, there wasn't much left of the plantation. Father and our two uncles lost their lives. Now that I think about it, perhaps it would be better if you will accept an invitation to come to supper at my house Saturday night. My house is located at the end of the street. It's the brick one with the white picket fence. Bricks were shipped in from back east by a freight company located right here in our town. Say 7 o'clock. You can give me your answer then."
Chapter 7.
The livery stable owner inspected the buckboard and determined that it needed more repair than he could accomplish. He did, however, have a buckboard in the back of the livery stable that he bought from a family that had left for greener pastures, as they put it. Orville asked, "What do you gents think about a new wagon?" Half Loaf said, "We will need another horse because the wagon is bigger. It will take two horses to pull it. Just so happens I have something to address that problem. Follow me, gents," said the livery stable owner. He walked out back of the stable, and in the corral were four horses milling around, each vying for attention. There were two grade horses that looked really good, and two big Morgan horses, and one tan gelding, and the other a brown stallion. They were all fine-looking horses. The tan gelding pranced and whinnied more so than the other three, so Orville walked over to him and rubbed the white tuft between his eyes. Orville waved me off to the side, said, "Well, I figure if we got the stallion, he'd be on the prod for every mare we came across. Better we settle on the tan gelding. Won't have to worry about him none." Orville winked at me, then said to the owner, "Reckon how much you've got to have of that broken-down horse and that broken-down buckboard." I grinned at the way Orville described the horse and wagon that he and I both knew we were going to buy. "What do you mean? You know that's the finest animal in the bunch, and as far as the wagon goes, you also know it's in tip-top shape," answered the owner. "No need to fuss. How much?" "Talking my old buckboard and trade," Orville asked. "Also got a real good saddle to throw in this little transaction." "Well, I really don't have no use for your wagon other than for spare parts, but I'll make you a mighty fine deal," replied the owner. "Let you have the wagon and the gelding for a fair price of $200. "Give you $150. Throw in the saddle," I said. "Sounds like we made a trade," the owner nodded. Half Loaf and me loaded all our goods from the old wagon into the new one, while Orville brought the gelding from the corral in the back. We had to swap out harnesses because we now had two horses to hitch to the buckboard. That cost us another $30 that we really couldn't afford. "I'm going to have to send a telegram to the bank at home and ask for more money," I said. "Maybe we can find some work in this here town they call Windy Butte. Why do you think they call it that?" asked Half Loaf. The old-timer said, "Probably 'cause back in 61 there was a big tornado come whistling through right down the middle of Main Street. Didn't tear down no buildings 'cause it just blew on that street. Only stirred up a powerful bunch of dust. Reckon that's why." Orville and Half Loaf headed out of town to set up camp, while I went to the mayor's house for dinner.
Chapter 8. Dinner was superb, and after we ate, the mayor asked me into the drawing room. "You reached a decision?" he asked. "Really don't believe I'm suitable to be wearing a badge, and besides, my partners and I are on our way to the Arizona Territories, to a place called Velvet Sky. My uncle has a cattle ranch there. I do appreciate your offer, but I must decline."
"Surely you can find a suitable candidate here in Windy Butte?"
"There is, however, something you could do for me. You could give the sheriff back his land. You could do this as a favor to me. Makes me very happy when people do favors for me. On the other hand, I tend to get unhappy when I ask for a favor nicely and nothing gets done. I asked the Swearinger brothers to do me a favor, and they refused." "Yes, yes, I see what you mean," the mayor said. "I believe we can grant you that little favor. I was just telling Theodore that Hadley had been sheriff long enough and earned enough to pay off his debt. I will have Theodore tell Hadley first thing in the morning. Is there anything else I might do for you, young man?" "No, I believe that's everything. Thank you so much for dinner and for offering me the job. Good night, sir. Please tell your lovely wife and daughter good night for me."
Chapter 9. I stepped onto the porch and was almost to the picket fence when I heard something in the bushes to the side of the house. I reached for my pistol, and as I turned towards the noise, I saw Melody waving at me. So I walked over to her. "I'm so glad I caught you," she exclaimed. "What is it that I can do for you?" I asked. "You have to help me. I'm trapped in this awful town. Will you help me?" And she batted her eyes at me. Her skin had an olive tint, her eyes were light and creamy amber with red-brown flecks, and she had dark brown shoulder-length hair. "I don't really see how I can help you," I said. "You need to talk to your father and explain to him how you're feeling. I'm sure he'll do something."
"Yes, he'll do something all right," she said. "He'll lock me in my room and throw away the key."
"Think you're being a little overly dramatic. Surely your own father wouldn't do that."
"You just don't know him. I told him about that young boy that wanted to come calling on me, and he talked to the boy's father and told him to keep his boy away from his daughter."
"Well, I think all fathers are protective of their daughters, especially when they're an only child. How about your mother? Can't she help?"
"She does everything he tells her to do. Won't you please help me?"
"Well, since your father and I have an understanding, I'll talk to him on your behalf. Would that be satisfactory?"
"Thank you so much. I just know he will listen to you. May I give you a thank you kiss?"
"I don't mind if you do," I said. She stood on her toes and kissed me on the cheek.
"Thank you again. I will never forget you."
And she slipped back around the corner of the house. I turned, stepped through the gate, climbed into the saddle, and headed for camp. Chapter 10. Orville had set up the tent just east of town, on a little knoll, with a mulberry tree standing alone at the top. They were both asleep when I arrived, so I didn't say anything to wake them. The next morning I awoke before they did. Usually Orville was awake first and had breakfast started. When he awoke, I asked him how he would like to have breakfast in town. "Well, that sounds like a winner," he said. "Let's wake Halfloaf and skedaddle. It'll be something to eat somebody else's cooking. Don't happen often enough." We saddled up and headed for town. The only eating place in town was located off Main Street on Bounty Street. We tied the horses out front, stepped up onto the boardwalk, and was headed in. I took the table on the right side of the room, and I sat with my back to the wall. A pretty young girl with light, pale green eyes and blonde hair came to the table and asked, "What can I get for you? The special today is pork chops with brown gravy and green beans and potatoes."
"Well, that sounds fine. We'll all have that."
"And what will you have to drink?" she asked. "We have iced tea, lemonade, and coffee."
"How on earth can you have iced tea in this hot weather?" asked Orville.
"We have ice shipped in from Boston by rail, from Mr. Tudor, known all over as the Ice King," she answered.
"Well, let us have some of that iced tea," said Orville. She was back in a little while with three tall glasses filled full of ice and dark liquid.
"Say, that ain't bad," said Orville.
"What do you think, Halfloaf?" I asked. "It has a bitter taste. I do not like it." Just then the waitress brought our meal. "I heard what you said about the tea being bitter. If you add some sugar to it, I'm sure you'll like it better," she explained. Halfloaf turned the sugar jar upside down and dumped the whole thing into his glass.
"Oh, no," shouted the waitress. "Just put in 2 spoons in 1 glass. Here, I'll bring you another."
"Thank you, senorita," Halfloaf said. We finished our meal, and Orville said, "I think I'll have me just 1 more glass of that there iced tea." Then the waitress brought it, and Halfloaf asked her what her name was.
"My name is Polly Graham. I was born here in Windy Butte, but I hope to go to New York someday and sing in the big opera house there."
"I also like to sing," said Halfloaf. "Perhaps we could meet tonight when your work is finished."
"I'll be finished around 6 o'clock.
"I will see you then," said Halfloaf.
Chapter 11. We left the eating place and walked up the street to the general store. It was large, dark, and gloomy, and it had more merchandise than any of the other places we had visited. The store clerk was completely bald, had bushy mutton chop sideburns that extended to the edge of the mouth and are connected to a mustache with no chin hair, and wore wire-rimmed eyeglasses. He was very thin, short in stature, and seemed extremely agitated when he spoke. Not exactly the personality you would expect in someone who had to deal with people all the time. We browsed for a while, and Orville gave a list to the clerk. "Can you have this filled by dark?" The clerk perused the list. It included coffee beans, new coffee grinder, assorted spices, baking powder, oatmeal, flour, cornmeal, salt, sugar, dried fruit, canned fruit, vegetables, honey, molasses, crackers, cheese, dried beans, salt, pork, bacon, vinegar, a new Dutch oven, 2 new wooden buckets, potatoes, dried beans, chili powders, tomato sauce, soap, 1 special smoked ham, a lantern, coal oil for the lantern, and new dungarees and underwear for me and Halfloaf. It also included a new hat for Halfloaf and 4 boxes of .36 caliber ammunition for Halfloaf's gun.
"Believe I can fill this without any problem. Haven't had an order this large in some time. Should have it ready by 6 o'clock,
the clerk said.
"We'll be back," said Orville.
Chapter 12.
We left and headed back to the camp. Then I stopped and said, "Wait a minute. How would you fellas like to sleep in a real bed tonight?"
"That sounds like a fine idea," exclaimed Half Loaf. "I do have to meet with Polly for a little while, and then I would like very much to sleep in a real bed."
"Well, that's fine. We'll meet you at the hotel directly across from the telegraph office," I told him. "Shall we say 8 o'clock? Orville and me will pick up our supplies and meet you there."
"I think the first meal I'm going to fix is Range Rider stew," Orville said. "Haven't had it in quite a while."
"Ingredients are 1/2 pound of green cooking apples, 5 tablespoons of butter, 3/4 pound of beef already cooked, 1/2 cup breadcrumbs, dash of nutmeg, 1/4 pound of onions, sliced, pinch salt, 3 pounds cooked sliced potatoes, dash pepper."
We picked up the supplies and loaded them into the buckboard, and Orville said, "I think I'll pass on the hotel. Got so used to sleeping on the ground in the army that I don't think I could be comfortable."
"Okay, if that's how you feel," I said. "See you back at the camp in the morning."
Chapter 13. The next morning after we had breakfast, we packed up. I told him I had to run an errand, then left for the mayor's office in hopes of persuading him to allow his daughter more freedom. "One thing we need to have an understanding about. I sure would hate to hear that my favor, which you said you would do for me, had been left undone. That would upset me in the worst way. I might just have to stop what I'm doing and return to Windy Butte." Well, after our talk, I felt certain that things would be better in the Madison household. When I got back to camp, everything was ready, so we headed out. That night after camp was set up, Orville decided to make use of some of our new supplies. He took out the makings for cornbread. Using the new bowl, he poured the batter into our cast iron skillet and covered it with a lid. In a little while, he bent to check the coffee, then lifted the lid on the cast iron skillet. The cornbread was golden brown and crusty, just the way I liked it. He opened some canned tomatoes, stirred them into a can of beans in the smaller skillet.
"Sure am glad that general store had all these canned goods," Orville exclaimed. "The farmers' wives had sold the canned vegetables to the store. Of course, even though it's getting colder, we still have to use them up plenty fast, or they'll spoil."
"I also bought us a smoked ham. Thought we'd like it better than beans and bacon all the time," he said. We dished up our meal, sat down to enjoy it.
"Have another surprise," exclaimed Orville. "Honey, to go on the cornbread. Always did have a sweet tooth."
What a meal. Of all the meals Orville had cooked, this one was one of the best. After the dishes and pots and pans were washed, we sat by the fire watching the flames. They flickered lower and lower until there was nothing but glowing embers. The moon was very bright tonight. It resembled a sparkling jewel on the bosom of the hard-packed dirt. We said good night, and each headed to our beds. I awoke early, estimating at least 1/2 hour before the sun would crest the horizon, and felt a nagging sensation that something was wrong. Gray twilight masked the area straight ahead.
Chapter 14. I saddled Sugar and went in that direction. After about 2 miles, there was a dried-out creek bed rutted with some deep gullies. There were a lot of rocks and boulders lying around, and it looked like we might have trouble getting the buckboard across. I scanned in both directions, but this looked to be the best place to cross, as the creek bed got deeper and wider in both directions. I went back to inform Orville and Half-Loaf of our problem.
"I knew I should have got rid of that blame wagon when I had the chance," Orville grumbled.
"We'd have gotten rid of the wagon, we wouldn't have all these fine meals you've been fixing."
"I reckon you're right about that," he said.
"What do you reckon we're going to do about the wash?" he asked.
"We'll work through it when we get there," I said.
When we got to the creek bed, Orville said, "I recall a time just like this in the army when we had to cross a big gully with the mess wagon. Moved all the rocks and boulders and filled the ruts with them. Rolled right over the top of them. It's like a real road."
"Sounds like a plan to me," I said.
"However, there is one thing. I want Half-Loaf to wear a pair of the gloves that we bought back in town. I don't want him getting blisters the way he did when we chopped all that wood."
"Well, let's have a quick cup of cold coffee and get started," he said.
When we moved all the rocks and placed them in the ruts, we drove the wagons across just like Orville said we could. I wiped the moisture from my forehead with my bandana, drank deeply from my canteen, then poured a little onto my hand, dabbed the water on my face and neck. Sure felt good. I suggested we stop for a while, rest the horses and ourselves, then continue on.
Chapter 15.
Might as well eat a plate full of cold beans and cornbread, Orville said. There's also something else I've been thinking on. Since the weather is getting cooler, the dampness seems to creep in my bones while we're lying on the cold ground. Thought it might make me a pellet the back of the wagon. Not getting any younger, you know. Spent many nights on the cold ground when I was in the army, but I was a lot younger then. Just can't do it no more. Whatever you want to do, Orville, it's okay with us, I said. There was still plenty of daylight, so we loaded up, headed out. I stared off in the distance and saw scattered mesquite trees and the scarce, dry, distorted tabasa grass. There was also tall, tree-like cacti scattered as far as we could see. It was a dry land, to be sure, and I looked further to my left and spotted smoke curling into the clear sky, probably a mile and a half away. It wasn't drifting at all, as there was no wind. I waved to the guys, and we headed towards the smoke. It took about an hour to arrive at a small farmhouse.
Chapter 16. It was a clapboard frame two-room house. The yard was hard dirt packed down from the horses and other animals. It was also hard, since there hadn't been any rain in a very long time. There was a thin, elderly woman with gray hair hanging wash on a corral fence. A gray-haired man was just coming out of the barn. He looked up and saw us and ran back into the barn. He returned with his carbine, cocked and ready.
"Stop right where you are," he said.
I raised my hands and said, "We want no trouble. We're just travel-weary and wanted some friendly talk with someone other than each other."
"Well, forgive my rudeness. Man can't be too careful. Step down, come on in for a cup of coffee. Name's Nolan Grigsby. I'll get the old woman to fix us some victuals for you, if you're mind to join us for supper," he said.
"We'd be mighty proud to join you," I said. "Mind if we water the horses?"
"You'd have to fetch the water from that barrel over yonder.
Please go sparingly, though. It's all we got till I go over to the neighbor for more. Our well went dry nigh on 5 days ago. We don't get some rain. Don't know what we'll do," he said.
"How many barrels do you have?" I asked.
"Got four, but can only carry two in my wagon," he answered.
"Well, we can carry two in our wagon," I said, "and that'll hold you twice as long. I'd be beholden to you if you'd do that."
"Thanks. How far is your neighbor's place?" I asked.
"Reckon it's about 12 miles or so, too far to go today. We can go in the morning if you've a mind to."
"Well, that sounds like a plan," I said. "Do you mind if we put our horses in your barn, maybe feed a little grain and brush them down? They don't get a lot out on the trail," I said.
"Help yourselves. Grain's a little short, so use it."
"I know. Use it sparingly," I finished for him. We took the animals into the barn, and it was really run down.
"Looks like these folks need more than a little rain to fix them up. After we haul the water tomorrow, we'll see if there's anything else we can do to help them," I said.
"Come on in when you're finished. Coffee's on the stove," said the old man. We finished up in the barn, used a little water on our bandanas to wipe the dust trail off, and went inside. "Have a seat there at the table. I already set the cups. All I have to do is fill them up," he said.
The lady of the house was busy stoking the fire of the old cast-iron stove.
She went to the counter and started peeling potatoes. When they were ready, she placed them in a skillet. Soon as they were brown, she put them in with some beans that were already cooked. Thought to myself, beans and taters again. But then, why was I complaining? These good folks were willing to share what little they had with us, and us being strangers. After we had eaten, Orville said, "Excuse me a minute, I need to get something from my wagon." And he returned a couple of minutes with a jar of berry jam and a slab of bread. "Thought we'd share this little treat with you fine folks after that great meal you just fed us," said Orville. I looked at the lady, and she was dabbing her eyes with her handkerchief.
"We ain't had nothing sweet in, let's see, must be over 2 years," she said.
"I noticed when I was in the barn that you got a cow. Is she fresh? She giving milk right now?" asked Orville.
"Sure is. Gives a gallon each day, morning and night. She gives too much for the two of us. I give the extra to our hogs. Sometimes I think they eat better than us. The old woman used to make butter, but the churn got broke, and we ain't been able to replace it," he said. "Times have been mighty hard round here. Why are you asking?"
"Well, I figured in the morning we might have us some hot cocoa. That's if everyone would like some."
"My, you boys are going to spoil us with all these surprises," she said. "I've never had hot cocoa. What is it?"
"Wait till morning, and you'll be even more surprised. I know it's something you'll like."
Orville said. Time to turn in, fellas. Let's go on out to the wagon and set up the tent. Night, folks, and thank you for such a fine supper, I said.
Chapter 17. The next morning we were up early. Orville took one of our buckets, milked the cow, and took it inside and asked Mrs. Grigsby if she'd mind if he fixed breakfast. She said, no, not at all. He went back to the wagon and brought in all sorts of victuals. Think it's almost Thanksgiving. How about hot cakes, oatmeal laced with honey, and hot cocoa? For dinner, smoked ham, green beans, and boiled potatoes, he said.
Well, that sounds heavenly, she exclaimed. Don't that sound heavenly, Nolan? And she looked over at her husband.
Chapter 18. After breakfast, we loaded the water barrels into both wagons and took off to the man's neighbor. Took almost an hour to reach his place. We reined up the horses and climbed down from the wagons. Man stepped out of the barn and walked towards us. Howdy, Grigsby. See you back for more water. My well's getting a little low, so can't let you have as much as you've been getting, he said. I sure appreciate what you've been doing for us, Pike, but we don't get water. We may just have to move on, said Grigsby. Well, maybe we can reach some kind of agreement to satisfy everyone, I said. How about if we pay for the water, I asked. Well, let me think on that a little bit. I reckon you could pay $1 a barrel. I could live with that. Let's fill 'em up, said Orville. I gave Mr. Pike 4 silver dollars, which he quickly stuffed into his pocket. We filled all 4 barrels and started back to Grigsby's place. I don't know how I'm going to be able to repay you. Don't have a penny to my name. Haven't had none for a year or so, he said. Well, don't trouble yourself about that, I said. Just be thankful for what you receive, as if it's a gift from God. When we arrived back at the farm, Mr. Grigsby said, don't know how we're going to unload those barrels from the wagon. They're mighty heavy. Chapter 19.
Well, that's not going to be a problem, Orville said. We unloaded barrels such as this all the time in the army. Do you have lids for these?
Sure, they're in the barn, said Grigsby.
Well, how about you and Halfloaf go and get them?
They brought 4 lids back and handed them up to Orville, and he fastened 2 of the lids to the barrels in our wagon.
Lest you think you'll be needing your wagon afore the barrels are empty, we'll leave these 2 in your wagon, he said.
Don't reckon I'll be needing it before the barrels are empty, he said.
Now let's find 2 long poles and roll these barrels down to the ground. There were some poles out behind the barn that Grigsby was going to use to build a pole shed.
Well, these'll do just fine, said Orville.
Carried the poles back to the wagon, leaned them against the ground, and let them down to the bed of the wagon.
Okay, let's tip this barrel onto its side and roll it slow and easy.
We got both barrels down without any mishaps and set them next to the house so Mrs. Grigsby would be able to get water without having to travel too far. Orville said, Halfloaf tote me 2 buckets of that new water into the kitchen. Time I got busy cooking that Thanksgiving dinner, I promised. Mrs. Grigsby had fresh coffee for us when we walked into the kitchen. She also had 2 cups of that hot cocoa if anyone wanted it. We finished the coffee, then Mr. Grigsby, Halfloaf, and me went outside, mostly to get out of Orville's way. I'm wondering if there are any chores you haven't had time to finish up, I asked.
Sure, there's a heap of things need fixing, said Grigsby, but I wouldn't ask you fellas to do my work for me.
I don't mean to insult you, but I don't recall you asking us, I said.
We worked until a little afternoon when Mrs. Grigsby came to the door and yelled, come and get it. Washed up, using a tad of water because this was going to have to last for a while. We went inside and everything smelled delicious.
Orville had really fixed a spread for us. We all sat down, bowed our heads, and he asked God for his blessings for this meal and for these fine folks who he had led us to.
We finished the meal and sat around visiting and listening to Orville and Halfloaf's tall tales. Even though Halfloaf was a lot younger than Orville, he had some stories that would rival those of Orville. We had leftovers for late supper, then went out to the wagon and settled in for the night.
I reckon we ought to think about leaving in the morning, said Orville.
Chapter 20. The next morning we told Grigsby we were leaving. Mr. Grigsby said,
Well, I noticed you could use a cover for your buckboard, and I just happened to have one that we used when we came from Nebraska. It has the hoops and canvas that turn your buckboard into a covered wagon. If you think you could use it, I'd be proud to get it for you. I sure would like it. Thanks a lot, said Orville. Mr. Grigsby went to the barn and returned with a large canvas. How about letting Halfloaf come with me and get the hoops? He asked. They returned with four wooden hoops. Mr. Grigsby showed Orville how to put them on the wagon, and sure enough, it looked just like a small covered wagon. This is just what I've been needing, especially since I'm going to start sleeping in the wagon, said Orville. When we were all packed and ready to leave, I asked the Grigsbys if they would pray with us. We all bowed our heads and asked the Lord to watch over and bless the Grigsbys. Then I asked that he guide us along the trail that he wanted us to travel and bless us all. And one last thing, I said, Mr. Grigsby, here's $4 to get more water. Thank you so much, he said. Go with God. Chapter 21. We mounted up, waved goodbye, and took out towards the northeast, heading for the Arizona Territory. We crossed from New Mexico into Arizona, and the land changed from open prairie to a mountainous range. To our rear, there was nothing but prairie grass gleaming gold and brown as far as the eye could see. In front, there were tall mountains with snow-tipped peaks. The weather seemed to change, and there was a brisk, cold breeze blowing down off the mountaintops. We put our jackets on. From what I had heard, Velvet Sky was about 4 days' ride from where we were. Chapter 22. The scenery was so much different from what we had seen in Texas and New Mexico. It was open as far as the eye could see. There was a lot of open range, but it was surrounded by mountains. Big, tall, snow-tipped mountains. I had to admit, it was beautiful. The horses' hooves and wheels of the buckboard failed to disturb the hard-packed road that seemed to stretch all the way to the mountains. After 3 days of traveling, with nothing out of the ordinary happening, we saw what looked to be a settlement in the distance. It was getting close to dusk, so Orville suggested we make camp and go into town first thing in the morning. Next morning, I stared at the halo of orange left by the sun as it peaked over the horizon. We mounted up and rode into town. There was a sign with Velvet Sky painted on it, about 10 feet from the buildings. The town itself was quite a surprise. Other than the weather-beaten buildings, there was nothing but purple-hued mountains on the horizon. The town was little more than a whistle stop. A few false-fronted buildings lined the narrow dirt road with just a small boardwalk between. There were handwritten signs that declared closed on all the buildings, even the barbershop and saloon. I didn't see any movement whatsoever, not even a dog, so we moved up Main Street to the livery stable. It was closed, so Orville brought the wagon to a stop in front of it, set the brake, and hollered, "Yo, anybody in there? If you're in there, we got some horses need tending." Halfloaf said, "I will get down and knock on the door. Perhaps they are gone like everyone else." He dismounted, banged on the door. "Who is it?" someone hollered from inside. "We just got into town. Our horses need feed and shelter," I answered. "Just a minute," came the reply. The door opened and a man peeked out. "Okay, come on in. I can help you," he said. "What's going on? Why is everything closed? Did somebody important die?" I asked. "Nope, Quince. Black Patch Forest is in town." "And who is Quince Black Patch Forest?" I asked. "He's just about the meanest, orneriest polecat in 5 counties. That's who he is. He killed our sheriff a week ago. Been running roughshod over town ever since. Ain't you never heard of him?"
"You say he's in town now,
and that's why all businesses are closed?" I asked.
"That's why," he exclaimed.
"Where might this fella be right now?" I asked.
"That's him yonder by the saloon."
He ducked back inside as they looked. "I reckon I better have a talk with this fella," I said. "Now, why you want to go messing in other folks' business?" Orville asked. "Like I said in the past, if I don't do it, then who will?" I stepped onto the hard-packed dirt road and started walking towards the saloon. I was about 20 feet from the saloon when this rough-looking man stepped down off the boardwalk. He was dressed in a black shirt and trousers, had shoulder-length black greasy hair, and a thin, crooked mustache, pockmarked face, and a patch over his left eye.
"Where you think you're going, kid?" he scoffed.
"Understand you've been a bad boy," I said.
"I don't know what you're talking about."
"I heard you killed the sheriff."
"Could be. What's it to you?"
"I reckon you and me need to go over to the jail and set you up with accommodations."
"A comma what?"
"There's a cell in the jail that has your name on it," I said.
"No man who walks the old earth can tell me what to do."
He threw a scathing glance towards me, warning me by that look that he wasn't going to go nowhere. Blood surged through my veins, sending a flash of heat over my whole body. Then I felt a calmness come over me as I realized what was going to happen. My bullet smashed into his chest after his pistol had cleared its holster. He fell off the boardwalk and into the street. Doors started banging as people ran into the street yelling, "Everything's going to be all right. Black Patch is dead." Folks started coming up to me, patting me on the back and shaking my hand. "Who are you?" someone asked. "My name's Jed Jenkins. My friends and me are here to visit my uncle. His name is James Seamus Jenkins. He owns a cattle ranch somewhere close to Velvet Sky." "I know Mr. Jenkins," said an elderly gentleman. "Is it possible you could point us in the right direction?" I asked. "Sure, take the right fork after you leave town, going west. About 10 miles out, you'll see a gate with a sign on it. Says Lazy Valley Ranch." "Much obliged," I said. Then I turned and headed back to the livery stable. Chapter 23. I told Halfloaf and Orville that as soon as we had some breakfast, we would start out for my uncle's ranch about 10 miles west of town. We'd been drawing with Rufus here about this town and came to the conclusion that it ain't no different than all the other towns we passed through. "Is there a good eating place in town?" I asked. "Yep, up the street, one block turn left. There you are." "Has it got a name?" "Used to be called Fred's or something like that, but Fred died and some of his kin took it over. Never did change the name. Sign is so faded now you can't read it nohow." "Thank you. We'll see you in a bit. How about taking care of our animals?" "Sure thing. See you in a bit." After we ate, we paid Rufus, headed west out of town, and turned south. The terrain was up and down with lots of greenery, grass, and trees. Ahead, there were two of the tallest mountains I had ever seen. We crested a rise, and there in front of us was a large gate with a sign proclaiming Lazy Valley Ranch. Under that, it said JSJ. Halfloaf said that it was the brand they used on their cattle. Off in the distance, there were little black and brown specks. We found out later they were cattle, several hundred of them. We rode for almost an hour. After passing a large horse corral, two large barns, a large bunkhouse, and various outbuildings, we saw a big U-shaped adobe two-story house. It had a red-tiled roof, a covered porch, and was held up by wooden poles. The porch ran the whole length of the front of the house. There was a brick courtyard with lots of flower beds on all three sides. There was an adobe wall surrounding the house and courtyards, and the entrance was a large iron gate. Orville stopped the wagon and jumped down. "This here's some fine place," he proclaimed. "Is this your uncle's place?" Halfloaf and me dismounted, tied our horses to the back of the wagon. A bulky, dark-skinned man came from our right side and asked, "Help you, gentlemen?" "Looking for James Jenkins. Would this be his place?" I asked. "Yes, this is his place. May I ask you what it is you want? I'm the foreman, and we're not hiring right now. We'll be working the spring, though," he said. "Oh, we aren't looking for work. Mr. Jenkins is my uncle. My name is Jed Jenkins. These are my friends." "Sure, I should have known you with your red hair, just like Mr. Jenkins. Is he here?" I asked. "No, he's away on business, he and his whole family. He'll return by the end of the week, but now you must come into the house and enjoy a cool drink after your long ride," he said. We walked through the iron gate, past some flower beds. Just then an oversized carved wooden door opened, and a young Mexican woman waited inside. "My name is Rosita. Please come in," she said. She was wearing a gray dress and white apron, and had her black hair tucked beneath a white ruffled cap. "Come this way into the parlor," she said. We followed Rosita, her heels bouncing off the tile floor. The room was large and had a stone fireplace in the center. There was a longhorn steer head above the mantel. The furniture included a leather davenport with matching chairs, heavy wooden beams crossed the ceiling, Indian rugs of bright red and turquoise hung on the walls. Beyond another archway was a dining room with a large, polished table that could easily seat 10 people. Beyond the dining room, through another archway, was an office with a large desk and several filing cabinets. I assumed the bedrooms were upstairs.
"Please be seated. I will bring refreshments," said Rosita.
She returned with glasses and a big pitcher of lemonade, cool and sweet.
"Anything else I can help you with till Mr. Jenkins returns?" said the foreman. "Since you're the nephew of Mr. Jenkins, you can spend the night in the house, but your friends will have to stay in the bunkhouse."
"I'll stay in the bunkhouse with my friends," I said.
"As you wish," said the foreman. "When you're finished with your lemonade, I'll show you the way. Rosita will call you when supper's to be served."
We finished the lemonade, set the glasses on the tray, and said, "Lead the way."
The bunkhouse was a large, tall structure made of adobe, with windows all the way around the walls. No matter which way the wind was blowing, it would blow through the bunkhouse. The foreman assigned us three bunks near the door where we entered. We had brought our bedrolls, so we rolled them out in the bunks.
"These look a lot more comfortable than the back of the wagon where I've been sleeping," said Orville.
The next morning we walked to the pump next to the hand-dug well. Orville primed the pump, filled the bucket with fresh water, wet his bandana, and wiped his face, then filled a dipper and drank deeply.
"That sure hits the spot early in the morning," he said.
Half-Loaf filled the dipper and took a drink.
"Yes, there is nothing as good as cool, fresh water from the well."
I filled the dipper and drank also.
I dipped my bandana into the bucket, wiped my forehead with a damp rag, shaded my eyes against the bright sun.
Rosita called from the front porch,
"Breakfast is ready, gentlemen. Come inside."
We went into the dining room, sat on the large table.
It was a little intimidating sitting at such a big table, just the three of us. Breakfast consisted of oatmeal, scrambled eggs, bacon, sausage, fried potatoes, buttered toast, fresh squeezed orange juice, and milk. They sure did put on a big spread, and I wondered if they ate like this all the time.
"I could get used to this ranching," said Orville.
"Sure beats army chow.
A whole heap of a lot."
"Yes, it's a fine meal," I said.
Chapter 24. When we were finished eating, we stepped outside and were met by the foreman.
"Perhaps you'd like to take a tour of the ranch," he asked.
"That's just what we were planning to do," I said.
Orville said, "Suppose I can ride Whitey, but I don't have a saddle. Treated my saddle when we upgraded the buckboard, remember?"
"It's not a problem," said the foreman. "We have many saddles."
We saddled the horses and joined the foreman in front of the barn.
"What would you like to see first?" he asked.
"Well, I always wanted to see some roping in Brandon," Orville said.
"Well, they're Brandon in the South 40 today. We'll join them there," the foreman said.
"This way, please."
We rode for half an hour at a pretty fast clip. As we crossed over a little rise, we saw hundreds of cattle. There was a fire off to the side with a dozen cowboys. Two of the men were roping and hog-tying a young cow. Another was heating a branding iron in the fire. Soon as the men had the cow secured, the one with the branding iron held the hot iron against the cow's back hip. The smell of burning hair and flesh was rancid.
"Kind of smells like a battlefield," said Orville.
"How many cattle do you have here on the ranch?" I asked.
The foreman answered, "At last count, there were 752, and that's not counting the calves."
"How many acres is the ranch?" I asked.
"Many acres of deeded land, and thousands of acres of free range. The entire ranch includes 260 square miles. I think that's a little over 166,000 acres. We have 20 cowhands riding for us, and we hire 15 more during the busiest season. We stay very busy all year round. There are 10 windmills spread around the range in strategic areas. We have one man whose only job it is to keep the windmills up and running. We have another man for all the repair work that needs to be done around the ranch.
Cattle always have water, even in the slow rainy season. It's a large lake located in the lower part of the range. We have 400 acres dedicated to growing wheat for feed during the hard winters. It's a large vegetable garden located behind the main house, and we grow enough vegetables that we sell part of them in town at the general store. It's one of the largest ranches in all of Arizona," the foreman concluded.
"I wish Pa could be here to see what his brother has accomplished," I said. "He'd be so proud."
"Thank you for showing us around. Now, I believe I'd like to ride alone for a while."
They said they would meet me back at the main house when I returned. The landscape was so much different than Texas. Don't misunderstand me. I'm a Texan through and through. I didn't say I liked it more.
just different. As I rode, I asked myself, could this maybe be a place where I could settle down, maybe raise a family? Somehow, I didn't think that was going to happen. I felt the Lord wanted me to keep traveling the country, helping those that needed help, and ridding the land of evil men that preyed on innocent folks. Was that what He wanted me to do? Chapter 25. Rode back to the ranch house, and Half Loaf was waiting for me as I entered the yard. The foreman said he received a telegram from Mr. Jenkins. He and his family will be arriving in 2 days. Well, that sounds real good, I said. I'm looking forward to meeting them. Don't even know if my cousins are male or female. Perhaps there will be a girl about my age, he said. You really want a girlfriend, with all the traveling we have to do? I suppose not. However, who says she has to be a permanent girlfriend? Guess you have a point, I said, and we went back to the bunkhouse to wait for supper. About 20 minutes went by, then Rosita came to the door of the main house and hollered, "Supper is ready. Come and get it." We washed up and headed for the house to eat supper. The table was, as usual, filled with delicious food, roast beef, candied yam, corn on the cob, boiled potatoes, bread and butter, with a large pitcher of lemonade. "I sure could get used to this," Orville said. "Me also," said Half Loaf. "Yes, it's a very good meal," I said. We finished with the meal and went to the kitchen to tell the cook how much we enjoyed her cooking. Afterward, we walked outside and sat looking at the sky. The orange tint of the moon was almost shut out from dark clouds. "Looks like it's going to come a gully washer," said Orville. "Well, rain's always needed on a cattle ranch," I said. "Well, let's get inside before we get wet," said Orville. We went inside, crawled into our bunks. The next morning after breakfast, we went for a short walk around the main house. We walked behind the barn, saw a group of men standing around the corral. They were jumping up and hollering. There in the corral was a young man riding a bucking horse. "He's making it look easy," said Half Loaf. "I know it is indeed not as easy as he makes it look." "That young man is Randy Brockman. He's the best bronc buster in 4 counties. And he's only 22 years old, said one of the men standing there. "We can't have a rowdy horse around the cattle when we're rounding them up. Randy's a top wrangler, could work any spread he wanted. Many others have offered him higher wages, but he will only work for Mr. Jenkins. Of course, it may be because he's the father of Miss Laura May Jenkins. She sure is a looker, but she only has eyes for the banker's son, Thad Newcomb. Randy don't like it much, but he says his turn'll come. You can take odds on it. I reckon if we're going to go look at this here ranch, I better go ask the foreman if I can borrow that blame saddle again," Orville said. "Meet you fellas back at the bunkhouse in, say, 15 minutes or so." We met Orville and the foreman at the bunkhouse. "Understand you want to tour the ranch again, is that so?" asked the foreman. "Yes, if you don't mind, but we'd like to go alone." "Well, that'd be fine. See that you don't get lost." After a couple of hours, Orville said, "I reckon we could look for a week and still not see all this ranch." "Yes, it's a big spread," I said. "At one time I dreamed of owning a spread like this." "Not too late. Maybe your uncle will let you have a section of this one." "I think God may have other plans for me," I said. "Can you be so sure what God wants you to do?" Orville asked. "I talk with him. He lets me know." "You mean God talks to you just like we're talking now?" "Well, not exactly like that, but I have no doubt when he wants me to know something. I never was much on this God stuff. Seen too many bad things during war," Orville said. "But you made it through, didn't you? Don't you think maybe God had a hand in that?" "Maybe. Have to think on that for a while. I'd have to say thank you, if and he did have a part of me getting back." "He's always waiting to hear from you, any time, day or night," I said. "Give it a try sometime." "Maybe." "I talk to God all the time," Half Loaf said. "It gives me a good feeling on the inside. Jed introduced him to me one night, not so long ago. Perhaps if you accept him in your heart like I did, it would be easier for you to talk to him." "Maybe," said Orville. "This sure is pretty country, ain't it? Reckon you're going to tell me God made all this." "Well, I think you know the answer to that question." Chapter 26. We rode until noon, then stopped at a pond. "It wasn't so cold I could stand a bath," I said. "Some folks take a bath even when it's cold," Half Loaf replied. "But not in the pond in the wintertime," said Orville. "Think I'm going to do it anyway," I said. "Jed, you'll freeze your you-know-what," said Orville. "What the heck? Got a fresh change in my saddlebags. I can dry off with my dirty ones. It's another reason I can't do it.
got no change of clothes.
I do, and I will go with you, Jed, said Half-Loaf.
Young pups ain't got a lick of sense. Go ahead, you'll probably catch pneumonia, and I ain't going to take care of you when you do.
Half-Loaf and myself tethered our mounts to a little bush over by the pond. Then we both took our fresh clothes out of our saddlebags and walked over to the edge of the pond.
Last one in's a rotten egg, I said, as I removed my clothes and waded into the freezing cold water.
Half-Loaf was right behind me. I looked at him, and he looked at me, and we were both shivering so bad we couldn't say anything. Again he looked at me, and I looked at him, and we both nodded our heads and headed for the bank. What we didn't realize was, while we were in the water, Orville had taken our clothes, both the clean ones and the dirty. Half-Loaf started saying something in Spanish.
I don't know what you're saying, I said, but I don't think it's anything nice.
I'm sorry, Jed, but I am so angry.
I know, so am I, but we've got to forgive an ignoramus like Orville.
What are you calling me, you young whippersnapper? You really need to give us our clothes back before we catch chill, I said.
We were both standing there in our birthday suits when I looked over the pond and saw a dust cloud. Someone was coming.
Come on, Orville, there's someone coming. I sure would like to get dressed to greet them.
Oh, all right, can't have no fun at all with little boys.
And he went over to a clump of bushes to retrieve our clothes. There wasn't any need to dry off, as the air had gotten us completely dry. However, we were covered with goosebumps.
You fellas know I was just playing, don't you?
You do know I love you both, said Orville.
Oh, sure, Orville, I said him. We love you, but I wouldn't be surprised if sometime when you aren't expecting it, we get even.
Aw, shucks, didn't think about that.
Who you reckon's coming in such a rush? He said.
Reckon we'll know soon enough, I answered.
The foreman rode up and stepped down.
Wasn't sure where you'd be. I sure didn't figure on you going swimming, at least not this time of year.
Why don't you use the bathtub in the house? Would have definitely been more comfortable than the pond.
There was a fella came asking for you to come to town.
They say why I was needed in town, I asked.
Nope, just that they wanted you to come.
Well, reckon I'll go see what they want. You fellas want to go to town?
All right to ride this saddle into town? Orville asked the foreman.
Absolutely, saddle's yours as long as you're guests of the ranch.
Are ya? Well, we'll go along.
Let's fill our canteens here and ride for town, said Orville.
Chapter 27 We rode into town and went to the livery stable. If anyone knew what I was wanted for, it would be Rufus.
Step down, fellas. Figured you'd stop here before you went to see the town council.
Have any idea what they want to see me about? I asked.
I reckon they'll offer you a job.
They know you turned down the job of sheriff before. I think they're going to offer you something a little different.
Where is this town council right now? I said.
Oh, they're probably over at the hotel, said Rufus. We don't have any other place for important meetings. Not since the town burned down about 5 years back.
All right, then, I said. You fellas want to go with me? I said, looking at Orville and Half-Loaf.
Well, I don't reckon they want to see us, just you, I'd imagine, said Orville.
All right, then. See you later.
Walked down Main Street to the Bronson Hotel. There were four men inside, two pacing, two seated.
Hello, gentlemen. You wanted to see me?
Well, yes, Mr. Jenkins. We wanted very much to meet with you about something of utmost importance. Please have a seat.
I took the spot across from the two men who were seated.
Can I do for you, gentlemen? I said.
We have a proposition for you. We know that you turned down the job for being sheriff, but we think we have something that would suit you much better than being a sheriff.
What might that be? I asked.
We want you to be our peacekeeper.
Well, isn't that just a sheriff with a different name?
Oh, no. We just want you to take care of troublemakers that arrive in town. You won't have to arrest drunks or anybody like that, just the ones who come into town wanting to cause trouble.
Like I said, sheriff with a different name.
Not interested.
Perhaps if you heard the salary, you might consider it.
I only use my gun at times of people needing help.
Now, if I'm here when one of these troublemakers come to town, I'd be glad to help you out, but no, I'm not available for your peacekeeper job.
Thank you.
But no thank you, I said.
I went back to the livery stable and told them what the council wanted.
Are we going to have this offered at every town we pass through?
You know, it might not be so bad. It could be a steady job, no more traveling around, said Orville.
I don't feel that's what God wants me to do, I said.
All right, if you say so. I reckon me and Half-Loaf will be at your side no matter what.
I really appreciate that, I said. Thanks. Now, let's go back to the ranch for some more of that good chow.
Chapter 28. We arrived back at the ranch just in time for supper. Rosita said, I thought I was going to have to throw it out to the hogs.
You should know I ain't going to miss one of the cook's fine meals, I said.
We moseyed around the ranch for 2 days, and I was very anxious to meet my uncle. Pa had talked about all his brothers a lot. He was real sorry about the way they had parted ways. He always wanted to visit with each one, but it never happened. I woke before everyone else and went to the house and took advantage of the bathtub. It was indeed much better than the pond. I changed into clean clothes, combed my hair, and went to eat breakfast. I was early, so I sat at the table. Rosita came in and asked, What are you doing here so early, Jed?
I took a bath so I'd be fresh to meet my uncle.
Maybe you're a little nervous, yes? Breakfast will be just a few minutes. Would you like some coffee while you wait?
Why, yes, thank you, Rosita.
She returned with a cup and a pot of hot coffee. Thank you, I said, as she poured a cup for me. You can pour the next one yourself. I waited about 10 minutes and Rosita served breakfast.
Hey, is you going to eat without us?
Orville asked when he and Half Loaf came into the dining room.
You both know I love you, but when it comes to food, it's not much of a race.
Your uncle, he is coming in today? Asked Half Loaf.
It's what the telegram said, I answered.
I'll bet you're excited, yes?
He is also very nervous, Rosita said as she was passing through.
Nothing to be nervous about. He's kinfolk, said Orville.
Well, I've never seen nor met him, nor he me, I said. He'll see your red hair. Know you're his kin, Orville said.
Oh, thanks for all the encouragement, I said. Think I'll go out to the corral and talk to Randy for a little while. As always, Rosita, the meal was fantastic. Please convey my gratitude to the cook. Told the fellas goodbye, left to go to the corral. Randy and a couple of men were getting a horse ready to ride. Randy was whispering in the horse's ear, and you could tell it was having a calming effect on him. Find it amazing how some men can be so gentle with animals while others are downright mean. I could see Randy was going to be busy for a while, so I climbed up on the corral fence to watch. Randy had finished talking to the horse and was putting the saddle on him. Almost finished, I could tell by the way the horse started prancing back and forth around the corral. Randy would turn him one direction, then the other. Just then, I heard a carriage pulling into the front yard. Chapter 29. I rushed around the barn just as the folks started unloading. I spotted my uncle first. There was no way to mistake him for anyone else. What with his red hair, it was almost the same color as Pa's. He finished helping the women down from the carriage, then he looked my way. He seemed to freeze in his tracks, turned to the women, said something. They all looked in my direction. He started walking towards me.
He told me in town that someone was waiting, but I had no idea.
And who might you be, young man? Have we met before?
No, sir, we haven't met, I said. But I do know who you are, and I've been waiting to meet you for a very long time. My name is Jedediah Isaiah Jenkins, and I believe you're my uncle.
Jedediah Isaiah Jenkins. I believe I heard that name before. How's your pa? He asked.
Pa's dead. He was killed over a month ago.
Oh, Jedediah, I'm so sorry. You came all the way from Texas by yourself?
No, I have some very good friends with me, said.
Let's go in the house. We can do some getting acquainted. I want you to meet your aunt, your cousins.
We went into the house. Come into the living room, my uncle said.
May I call you Jed?
I prefer Jed, sir.
Let me go upstairs and freshen up a bit, then we'll visit. Please sit here in this chair. It's the most comfortable one.
I was sitting in the big chair when a young girl with hair the color of her father's came in.
Who are you? You have hair the same as Papa and me.
My name's Jed, and the reason my hair is the same as yours is because we're cousins.
I didn't know I had any cousins. Are you the only one?
Probably the only one from Texas. I don't know if you have others somewhere else. What's your name?
It's Jennifer. Will you be staying long?
Really can't answer that question because don't know when or if I'll have to leave.
I hope you stay a long time. I have to go now. It's nice meeting you, Jed.
My uncle and me had a very nice time getting acquainted. He couldn't understand what I was doing traveling around the country and getting into gunfights. Showed me around the ranch and to some special places that only he knew about.
He introduced me to the rest of my cousins and my aunt, and he told me how he had battled Indians, floods, droughts, rustlers, and cattle fever. A few years back, he'd lost over half the cattle. Back in 60, he had to completely rebuild the house and the barn when they burned down. He said it was almost like starting all over again. But here we are, he said, very successful.
Chapter 30. One day, when we were riding back from one of the special places, he asked me if I would consider staying on a spell, so I could get to know the whole family better. I tried to explain to him that I had to do what God wanted me to do. "Don't you think God might want you to live with family?" he said. "I'll pray about it," I said, and I did just that while riding back to what could be a home for me. When we rode into the yard back at the ranch house, Half Loaf was waiting for me. "There's a telegram for you, Jed," and he gave it to me. Now, who'd be sending me a telegram? I wondered as I ripped it open and read, "You are needed in Angry Orchard, Colorado Territory. There's a group of 4 men terrorizing our town. We heard about you from my brother in Windy Butte, New Mexico Territory. He said that you helped them with a similar problem. We are willing to compensate you for your time if you would be willing to help us. Please, if you can, come at once. Cordially yours, C.D. Watkins, Mayor." "Well, I guess I know now what I'm supposed to do with my life," I said. "Thank you, Lord, for letting me know so quickly." I would like to have stayed and visited some more, but I was needed elsewhere. I tried to explain to my uncle that God guides me on a path as I travel a land helping those that need help. "I really don't understand," he said, "but I do accept that you are your own man and have to do what you feel in your heart. Here it is. You just arrived. We've gotten to know one another, and now you're already leaving." "Thank you for understanding," I said. "Now, if I could ask you for one more thing. I really don't care for long goodbye, so could you please explain to your family I had to leave suddenly? Tell them how much I enjoyed meeting and visiting with each one of them." "Well, I can do that for you," my uncle said. "Remember, you'll be in our prayers always. If you're ever back this way, you'd better come visit. Bye, Jed. Travel safe." "Thank you, sir. May God bless you and yours," I said. I rounded up Orville and Half Loaf, told them about the telegram, and that I felt this is something God wants me to do. I wasn't asking them to follow me, but if they wanted to, they were more than welcome. "Think you can get rid of us that easy?" said Orville. Half Loaf said, "See, I agree. I will follow you wherever you want to go." "Well, let's get a good night's rest. Tomorrow, we go to Angry Orchard, Colorado Territory." This has been Velvet Sky, Arizona, written by J.C. Halsey, narrated by Chaz Allen. Copyright March 15, 2015 by J.C. Halsey. Production copyright 2015 by J.C. Halsey. You're invited to hear a short excerpt of the continuing adventures of the Traveler, the next exciting chapter in the lives of Jed, Orville, and Half Loaf, and a new character is joining the crew in Angry Orchard, Colorado. Well, we had talked it over and decided that I should go ahead by stagecoach. I could get there a lot faster than if I traveled with them. I do wish I could spend more time with my uncle. I'd just met him, and I was enjoying visiting with him and his family. However, this telegram changed all that. I was needed elsewhere because someone was in trouble. We decided that Orville and Half Loaf would come later with the buckboard and to bring Sugar, my Appaloosa. I could travel there in a week's time if I went by stagecoach. Traveling 20 miles a day in the buckboard would take a month to get there. If the town needed help against these hooligans, then I needed to get there as soon as possible. We left my uncle's ranch and went into Velvet Sky. I would catch the stagecoach there, so I gathered what little belongings I had, rolled up my holster and gun, packed them in my haversack, and waited for the stage to arrive. Stage line clerk said it should arrive about a half an hour. I asked the clerk some things about the stage, and he explained that about every 50 miles it would stop at a relay station or home station to change out the horses and get something to eat. You would have as long as it took to change the horses to eat your meal. He pointed to a poster on the wall and said, "Maybe you'd better read that poster." The poster read, "You will be traveling through Indian country, and the safety of your persons cannot be vouchified by anyone but God."
Interesting, I said.